Welcome to Animal Voices, the weekly radio show dedicated to developing greater compassion for all living creatures. My name is Marge Adams, and in the studio with me are co-hosts Carl Loskin and John Pranger. At the controls, our regular technician, Alan Jensen. We have a very full hour ahead. At the top of the show, Deb Gleason, an animal rights activist who operates a dog walking business on the North Shore. She'll be telling us about the joys and challenges of working with dogs. Following Deb Gleason, we will be hearing from Kelly Bunting, a spokesperson for the Coalition for No Whales in Captivity. As most of you have heard, Luna, the playful orca whale, died a few days ago after a very unfortunate encounter with a ship's propeller. Kelly will be speaking about that, as well as giving us an update on the issues of whales in captivity at the Vancouver Aquarium. In the second part of the show, Carl Loskin will be doing an interview with Victoria Butenko, I'm sorry, who is a raw food advocate. That will be taking place at 12:35. Deb Gleason, our first guest, who is an animal advocate, I believe she's on the line now, but let me tell you that she was a police officer for several years in Ottawa, Ontario, and she left that job to set up her own dog walking business in that province, which was very successful. Last January, Deb opened a business on Vancouver's North Shore, which is called We Take the Dogs Out. The feedback is very, very loud. I'm sorry. Deb Gleason, are you on the line?
Yes, here I am.
Oh, hi, Deb.
Hi.
Sorry about that interruption, but may I go ahead now and ask you to tell us why you gave up being a police officer in order to operate this dog walking business.
Sure, I can do that. I was a police officer for 6 years in Ontario, and although I loved my career and had it was a great experience. It was quite a learning experience for me. I was missing some things. I was working a lot of long hours and a lot of shift work, and I really had a strong desire to be out mountain biking and walking with my dogs and doing all the things that I saw my friends able to do. And I just thought, you know, I think this is the time when I need to break free and do my own thing. So at that point, I started my own business. That was back in 2000, and got walking with dogs and absolutely fell in love with the concept of being out with not only my dogs every day, but with other dogs who were home alone and needed some friends.
So it was a real pleasure rather than work, huh?
It was, actually. It was amazing, the difference in working 12-hour shifts and, you know, sort of sometimes very difficult situations to suddenly being out in the woods with dogs all day.
Right. Now, yeah. Tell us about the services you provide in your business, will you?
Sure. What I do is I go around to people's homes during the week when they're usually at work or off at school or whatever the case may be, and I pick up their dog in the lunchtime area. So sometime between about 12 and 1, I'll come by. I'll pick the dog up and we'll put them, they'll come in the shuttle and we'll go to the park. The park, when I say that, I mean anything from the rainforest to the beaches to whatever the North Shore has to offer that dogs love. So we'll go for a group walk for about an hour, depending on the day. Sometimes the dogs are feeling a little more energetic and we'll add a little bit to the end of that until they're nice and pooped out. And then I drive everyone back home and tuck them into their place for an afternoon nap.
I see. So they have to be tired by the time they get home, huh?
That's my goal every day.
Do you try and match up the dogs in any way?
By size, is that what you mean?
Yeah, because of the endurance test that some of them might be undergoing if they're very tiny. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. Once the dogs get going with me for a couple of weeks, it's amazing how their endurance actually really improves. So I do find that after a while, after the dog's been coming for a while, that there isn't really much of a difference between a German Shepherd and a Yorkshire Terrier. They both want to be out there playing for the full hour, just like anyone else.
And are these dogs off leash all the time, or how does that work?
You know, my goal is to always have the dogs off leash, and the way that I manage that is I do small groups. So I'll take up to about 4 dogs at a time out, and I feel like dogs really get a lot more out of their adventure with me when they're off leash, so they can run and sniff and do things at their own pace.
Right.
You know, there's the odd dog that doesn't do well in an off-leash situation. And, you know, I have to respect that, and that dog will stay with me, but I don't run into that very often. Most dogs, once they get going in the group and understand how it works, they're excellent off-leash.
I see. They like to be together, I guess. No, that's the nature of a dog, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's a real instinctual thing. They like to be part of a pack.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to think of myself as the pack leader, and I always have a pocket full of homemade cookies, and that really helps keep the dogs with me.
I see. It sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
Do they go out? You go on the shore, don't you, at times?
To the North Shore?
Well, I mean, walking along the shore of the water.
Yeah, we do. We'll do some visits to the beach. We do all kinds of things. If it's a day where I think the dogs need to be cooled down, we'll go to a place where they can swim. And if it's a day where we want to get out of the rain, we'll go into the sort of deeper woods where it's not quite as wet on us pouring mm-hmm. down. So we vary it depending on what the day brings.
I see. Now, you must have certain criteria to judge whether or not a dog is going to be successful with you. And I'm just wondering, when an owner phones you up and says, I'd like you to take my dog walking, do you have certain requirements?
Yeah, I do. You know, my groups, what I like to maintain is a really comfortable group of well-socialized animals. And that way, everyone feels really comfortable in the vehicle before and after the walk, and also when we're walking. I want the kind of dogs that want to stay with me, the kind of dogs that like to be with other dogs. And the way that I sort of make sure that's going to happen is I do an interview with folks and with their dogs before we sign up. And it really, it's quite a simple process. I just come to their homes and meet them and meet their dogs, and we'll just sort of talk about what kind of walks their dogs are used to, and if they're used to, you know, playing with others, and if there's any aggression issues, and we'll sort of judge based on that. If I feel like it's not going to be really a perfect match, then I often will suggest that maybe they find a dog walker that can do private walks instead of group walks.
Oh, I see. And your walks are always in groups, are they?
Yeah, that's right.
And usually how many dogs?
I take 4 dogs at a time.
I see. Now, are there certain restrictions, bylaw restrictions on the North Shore that you have to meet?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's very timely. In fact, there's some new legislation that's going to be tabled in the North Shore in the next little bit. I'm not sure exactly what stage they're at, but I do know that they're trying to put some limits on the numbers of dogs and the numbers of dogs that can be off-leash with a particular dog walker. And there's a group in the North Shore that's rallying to try to keep things, you know, fair for everyone, fair for the dog walkers and fair for people who need the service. I guess the fear is if the restrictions are too tight, then the prices will have to go up because dogs will not be able to go out in as large a group as what people are used to. So there's definitely some change in the air, and I'm hoping that the Dog Walkers Alliance in the North Shore will get some satisfaction as far as keeping things fair for them as well.
Are there restrictions as far as locations for walking a group of dogs, or could that be just anywhere on the North Shore?
Well, you know, there are some restrictions. There's a few places that are a no-no. There's along the Cypress. Some of the trails are along Cypress Bowl are not allowed. That's in West Vancouver. As far as North Vancouver, there are certain places where the city likes to see the dogs, certain parks, and certain parks where they don't. But generally, I think if you go to any park or any wooded area or any trail, you're going to see signs, dogs are allowed on leash or they're not. And, you know, basically that's sort of my rule of thumb is if there's a place where it says no dogs, we don't go. And if there's a place where it says dogs on leash only, we don't go. We try to follow, you know, what the city and what the municipalities have set up.
I see. Tell me about the reception you get when you go to pick up a dog.
You know, that is one of the best parts of my job because after a few times when the dogs get to understand what's going to be happening when they see my face, it's just an absolutely wonderful experience. They wake up from their little, you know, morning sleep and they just start wiggling and they're all excited and a lot of them are crying. And I have one new dog who just started a few weeks ago and she lives in an apartment building, and I came to see her on Monday after we'd been together for a couple of weeks, I guess, and I came this Monday to see her, and she basically dragged me down the stairs to the car, and she's only 18 pounds. She dragged me down the stairs to the car, and she was squealing the whole way, so that made me feel very good.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Do most of these dogs walk 2 or 3 times a week, or what happens? Are you the only walker, or does their owner take them out? Can you tell me anything about that?
Yeah, generally most of the dogs have parents who are working 5 days a week, or they may have some variation on that schedule. So I usually walk the dogs either on a five days a week, or sometimes it's 2 or 3, depending on schedules. But, you know, for the most part, it's either 3 to 5 days a week for each dog.
Oh, I see that.
But, I'm open. If people want to walk once a month with me, that's fine, too.
Sure.
I just, what's really important to me is that these dogs get a chance to get exercise during the day, which they normally wouldn't because people are busy. Life is busy.
Right. Dare I ask you about the charge?
Absolutely. You can ask anything you like.
Okay.
The charge is $18 for a walk, mm-hmm. and that includes the pickup, the one-hour hike, and the drop-off, as well as complimentary towel service for the muddy feet.
I see. Uh-huh. And now, if someone wanted to contact you, can you tell us how they could do that?
Yeah, you can visit my website. It's wetakethedogsout.com, and there's links there to send me an email.
And you have a telephone number as well?
Yep, the telephone number is 778-836-9255.
Great. It sounds as though you really love your job.
I do really love my job, and I really love the way the dogs feel about getting out with me and the exercise and the happiness that it brings them. I just think it's invaluable for them.
Great. Thank you so much, Deb, for this interview.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Deb Gleason, who is the owner-operator of a dog walking service in North Vancouver, on the North Shore. Now, our next perhaps we're going to have just a little break first, please. Introducing our next guest, I would like to remind you that Victoria Butenko will be on after the intermission at 12:35. So stay tuned to hear Victoria talking about raw food. And now on the line we have Kelly Bunting of the Coalition for No Whales in Captivity. And welcome to Animal Voices, Kelly.
Hello, Marge. Thank you.
Now, I know there have been the interesting and unfortunate happenings this week with Luna.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like you to maybe tell us a little bit about that sad situation and how it played out and so on. Can you tell us that?
Sure. Now, Luna was lost from his pod, 5 years ago. He took a wrong turn and ended up being lost from his family, and he was a baby. In the States, when Springer, another lost baby whale, was lost its pod, the fisheries department in the States immediately reacted to get Springer back to the pod because these are endangered animals. So we want to keep as many animals healthy and together and having babies as possible. So in the United States, they acted. Here in Canada, the DFO did nothing. Luna was lost from his pod, and the DFO did nothing. So until 3 years after the fact. So he was in Puget Sound for 3 years and getting in the way of boats and starting to become a bit of a problem. And then finally the DFO took some action. But the problem is they wouldn't guarantee that when they moved Luna, if it wasn't successful, that he wouldn't end up in captivity. So the First Nations people, as well as No Whales in Captivity and other organizations, weren't happy with this. We wanted to be guaranteed that Luna wouldn't end up in the Vancouver Aquarium. So because they wouldn't guarantee that, the First Nations disrupted the move and didn't allow Luna to get moved. So Luna stayed in Puget Sound. This was 2 years ago. So now he had gotten kind of habitualized to the boats, was coming too close to boats, and the DFO now decided they weren't going to do anything. And then 2 weeks ago, he was hit with a motor and killed by the motor of the boat, the propeller.
Yeah, very sad. I know an awful lot of people mourned his loss.
Mm-hmm.
He's a favorite creature on the West Coast.
Yeah.
Does the DFO have responsibility for endangered marine animals?
They do, and they need to, what we'd like to see them do is prepare a firm policy. They don't have a firm policy of what, how to deal with an endangered whale that's lost from its pod, and we want one of the policies to be that there is no option for the whale to end up in captivity. So we'd encourage people to write letters to the Prime Minister's office, if I can give the email.
Certainly.
It's pm@pm.gc.ca, pm@pm.gc.ca, and if you can send off a note saying that you'd like to see policies in place that would make the DFO act more quickly and ensure that the whale didn't end up in captivity.
Yeah, do you think that any important lessons have been learned from the life and death of Luna?
Well, I mean, I don't think any lessons were. We knew that it was going to eventually happen, so I think that the DFO is. I hope that they learn from this and react more quickly next time. I think all along we were saying that he needed to be reunited with his pod, and this should have happened much sooner.
Mm-hmm. That was the big mistake, was not acting soon enough. Huh?
Right.
Yeah, I see. Now, the Vancouver Aquarium will be celebrating its 50th anniversary this year.
That's right.
Now, in spite of many years of protest against the captivity of dolphins and whales, the aquarium still has several. I'm not sure of the number, but you probably do.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that they, in disregard for a bylaw, have acquired two more dolphins just this last October. Can you speak to that?
That's right. Yes, 50 years of cruelty, we call it. It's a very sad occasion that they're celebrating 50th anniversary of the Vancouver Aquarium. So there's many events going on to celebrate this, which we see as a sad event. And we're looking for volunteers who could help us with our events to protest these celebrations. So if people could phone No Whales in Captivity if they were willing to help, our number is 604-736-9514, 736-9514, or you go to our website, which is nowhalesincaptivity.org. Right now we're currently investigating the Vancouver Aquarium's violation of the Park Board Whale Bylaw. There's a bylaw, 1996. Of 1996 that says that they can't bring in any whales that were caught in the wild after 1996. So when this bylaw was enacted, the intent of the bylaw was that no more whales would be brought in and that they would be phased out. But since that bylaw was enacted, four more whales and dolphins have been brought in to the aquarium. So the last two that came in the summer, in October, one was caught in 96 in the wild in Japan, and one was caught in 2003. So they're definitely in violation of the bylaw that says they can't bring any whales in that were caught after 96. And what we're doing now is putting a case together with some students from University of Victoria, law students, to try and sue the Park Board for not enforcing the bylaw. And when they had told the parks or the Vancouver Aquarium not to bring in these two dolphins, so these specific dolphins that came in October, the aquarium told the Park Board we're bringing in these dolphins, and they said, no, you can't. And 2 days later, the aquarium brought them in anyway, and we have documents that prove that this dialogue. So, but since then, the Parks Board has done nothing to enforce the bylaw. So they're in violation of the bylaw, and the Parks Board has done nothing about it. And we believe they're not doing anything because the head of the Park Board is a Vancouver Aquarium staff. So it's very corrupt and unfair. So anyway, we're looking into that. And the aquarium, we know that the aquarium in Japan has already replaced those two dolphins that the Vancouver Aquarium bought from them with two more from the wild. And one of the things in the bylaw is that they would not cause any other whales to be caught from the wild by purchasing from one aquarium. They wouldn't cause more to be caught from the wild. And these two have already been replaced with wild dolphins.
And you have been able to follow paperwork on these whales then, huh?
That's right, yeah. We're getting, the law students are getting all the documents together for us.
That's quite a feat, I understand.
Yes. Yeah, so hopefully we'll have more on that soon. And the excuse of the aquarium for violating the bylaw is that, oh, well, they were rescue dolphins. It's not the same. They were rescue dolphins, which is ridiculous because a rescue dolphin is a dolphin that you would rehabilitate and release. These are dolphins that are going to be forever in captivity. And in Japan, there's no such thing as a rescue dolphin anyway because it's actually illegal to cut dolphins from nets and release them in Japan. So they're definitely not rescue. Mm,
I see. It sounds like a bit of a conflict of interest, doesn't it, when the Parks Board head is on the staff of the aquarium?
That's right, and that's a big problem.
Has your group considered working on that issue?
Well, yes, we're looking at that too. It's the park board, the head of the park board commissioner. What she says is that when there's any issue to do with the Vancouver Aquarium, she will not vote, is what she has said. And in the city rules, it says that that is acceptable, that if there's a conflict of interest, if the person doesn't participate in that discussion. So it's unlikely that she wouldn't participate in the background. I would think she would be giving her opinions. So that's yet to happen. We'll see what happens when there is an official vote.
I see. Now, Carl has a question for you, Kelly.
Oh, great.
Well, hi, Kelly. Hi. And on Monday in the Globe and Mail, Mark Hume wrote a wonderful editorial about Wales, the history of Wales, and he said that the biggest danger could be that these whales are being slowly poisoned to death. And he quoted that Environment Canada said that the level of toxic chemicals in the southern whales are 3 times higher than levels known to cause immunotoxicity in harbor seals.
Mm.
And so that's a terrible indictment of the health of the oceans and how, you know, these whales are at the top of the food chain. I guess we're at the top of the food chain, but they're higher, and they're being poisoned.
Yes, I've heard some people refer to it as we should be looking at the whales as the canary in the mine. When the canary dies, you know, there's problems in the mine. These animals are so toxic, full of toxins. We really have to do something about all the chemicals that we're pouring into our ocean and that we use in almost everything we make. That is a huge problem that needs to be addressed.
Now, Kelly, I if you would bear with me, I'm just going to read two paragraphs or three paragraphs from the Mark Hume's editorial in the Globe and Mail. And just give a rundown of the killing of whales here on the British Columbia coast. And he says that people have been killing and harassing killer whales for a long time on the west coast. Only some have died accidentally, as Luna did, as we actually know that she got sucked into the propeller of a tugboat.
Right.
I don't think it was mentioned this morning. In the 1940s, Mark Hume writes, the Canadian Air Force used killer whales for target practice in the Strait of Georgia. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. That's
fishermen,
true.
Thinking the whales were eating their salmon, routinely shot them. And those practices fell out of favor. After those practices fell out of favor, the net crews arrived, introducing a new kind of mortality, death in captivity. And I guess that refers to the Vancouver Aquarium.
Mm-hmm.
In the late 1960s, the sheltered waters of the Pacific Northwest became the hunting grounds of aquariums. Displayed in tanks, their normally erect dorsal fins flopping over. Killer whales drew big crowds until people began to feel uneasy about watching beautiful, intelligent creatures jumping in swimming pools.
It's very sad. The Vancouver Aquarium and other aquariums trying to claim to be conservation institutions, which is just a huge joke, because they are a huge part of the problem that these are endangered species now. When they began capturing whales for display at aquariums, they picked the strongest and usually females, because they were most docile. And now we have a shortage of females in the wild, and obviously, which is poses a problem for the whole cycle of more being born.
Yeah, what is your feeling about Luna now on this regard of captivity? Was it kinder to leave her free as she was, or should she have taken, or should the DFO and the native people just accepted that she may go into captivity and tried to save her by taking her back to her pod?
No, I don't think that captivity can ever be an option. It's just such a horrible existence for the whales that it's much better for him to have been in the wild, living a happy life, and then this unfortunate event happened, and it's very sad and unfortunate, but it would have been worse for him to be in captivity now for the next who knows how many years in this horrible environment. It's really They say it's excruciating cruelty on a level that we can't even understand.
I agree. I remember going to the demonstration for Bielsa when she was being about to be transported down to San Diego, I guess it was.
That's right.
And you could just feel the sadness and everybody who attended that rally and mm-hmm. crying about mm-hmm. Bielsa.
And it seems I was at that rally also. It was so ridiculous to me to see how they hoisted Bielsa into the air with on the sling with a helicopter, and to look up and see a whale hanging in the air. I mean, it's so wrong. She has no business being in the air. She's meant to be in the ocean. It's very sad.
Yeah, and I thought she was so close to being free, you know, right there in Stanley Park.
Yes.
And here, instead of that, they kept her in that pond.
Yes. Very sad.
That's so awful. So, well, I'm glad your group is working hard, as usual.
We are. We have one more event that we're planning that we would love for people to come and see. We're sponsoring a movie at the Animal Voices Film Festival, which is June 3rd and June 4th of this year, at the H.R. McMillan Planetarium. And we're sponsoring, No Whales in Captivity is sponsoring the movie Fall from Freedom, which is a wonderful movie. I would encourage people to come and see about how awful it is for whales to be in captivity. It also shows a wild capture of dolphins, wild capture of belugas, and wild capture of orcas, and how violent that is. They actually wrestle these animals down. They jump on their backs and wrestle them. Really ugly, and it has many scientists in it who previously worked for aquariums and then realized how cruel and awful it was and now speak out against them. So I'd love for people to come and see Fall from Freedom.
Great. Just on that note, are any attempts being made to replace whales from captivity into the wild again? I know we had that one from the Hollywood Free Willy. Is there anything like that going on right now?
There's a man named Rick O'Berry who used to be the flipper trainer, and he caught many, many, many dolphins, was involved in their capture, and wrestled them and did all these ugly things. And then after years and years of making millions and millions of dollars and living a wonderful lifestyle, he realized how wrong this was and how intelligent they were and how, you know, he really regretted all of these awful things he did. So now he speaks out against whales and dolphins in captivity, and he does a release program. He used to train the dolphins in captivity. Now he takes dolphins that were in captivity and puts them in pens in the ocean and retrains them how to catch fish and then releases them. So he says dolphins are wonderful candidates for release, and they can definitely be retrained on how to live in the wild. So he works on that project.
So he's had success then getting them released back to nature.
Yes, definitely.
That's great to hear. They're very intelligent animals, aren't they?
Exactly.
Yeah, so they learn quickly, I'm sure.
That's right.
Now, you have another a protest coming up in June. Could you tell us about that?
No, there's many events happening at the aquarium for their celebration. So we don't have any details yet, but if people could contact us, we'd love to just get some more volunteers, and then we can let the details out later.
Yeah, and maybe you could give us your website once again.
Yes, please. It's nowhalesincaptivity.org, nowhalesincaptivity.org, so you can reach us through there or phone us at 736-9514.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being on the show today, Kelly.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate having you, and good luck in all your work.
Thank you.
I greatly admire Coalition for No Whales in Captivity.
I appreciate that. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Kelly Bunting of Coalition for No Whales in Captivity. Now we'd like to have a little more music, please, Alan. This is CFRO 102.7 FM on your radio dial, Co-op Radio. Now we have a guest that Carl Loskin is going to be interviewing, Victoria Butenko. Carl?
Yes. By the way, our webpage is www.animalvoices.org, and many of our programs can be heard on our webpage. We get them posted over there. So www.animalvoices.org. Well, Victoria and Igor Butenko are highly acclaimed authors and inspirational speakers. They'll be coming to Vancouver, and they'll be here on the 25th of March. We'll hear more about that. And what they do is they explore the connection between raw food and optimum health. And there's going to be a one-day seminar on the 25th, Saturday the 25th of March. That's in a week's time. Well, welcome to Animal Voices, Victoria Butenko.
Oh, hello.
Yes, nice to hear from you. And you live on the wonderful Oregon coast there near Medford. And I loved what you said, you know, because we're returning some of the wisdom from the past. And you wrote that there was a Russian proverb that said, news is something old that has been long forgotten. And could you tell us why you're saying that?
Because I say this, the new is something well forgotten. That's our Russian proverb. Because we now applying lots of green smoothies, blended green smoothies to our diet. That has been discovered years ago, but never actually became popular. So I'm trying to make it, to promote it and make it really popular now.
Yes. Now, give us a little bit more information about, the background of this is that we're looking at another way of the old, which is what that people didn't have so much, didn't vegetate towards processed foods and destroying their foods with heat. So bringing in some of the old, like what the old people used to do in the old country.
Oh, you mean, I'm an immigrant from Russia, and in Russia we have a horrible diet. When we came to the United States, we embraced horrible American diets, and then we became so ill that the doctors told us that we wouldn't survive for long because I developed arrhythmia, irregular heartbeat, and my husband had rheumatoid arthritis and hyperthyroid, so bad, six times bigger than normal. And my son had developed diabetes, and my daughter was diagnosed with asthma. And we were so ill that we couldn't function, and we started to look alternative, and then we found out that the way of eating processed food was not right. Lots of health, a big part of health depends on how we eat. And one day we met a lady who was eating only raw, and we went cold turkey on raw food, my family of four, in 1994 in January, and since then we've been staying on raw food.
So what is the magic of raw food? I mean, why does it give us vitality?
The food in its natural state is full of nutrients, enzymes, and different minerals, essential amino acids. And when it's cooked, it's devitalized. It actually begins to have toxins in it, and some toxins are cancerogenic. So raw food is really beneficial. And it's interesting that we started to feel benefits within a matter of days of eating raw food in my family. However, now lately I've been concentrating not just on raving about raw food, but sharing with people about the pitfalls that we went through while being on raw food for over 12 years, because we made some mistakes, which I observe could be typical for many people. And in my lectures now, I concentrate on how to avoid making mistakes, how to do the best on raw food diet.
So maybe you can tell us some of these pitfalls that most people fall into.
Yes, I would love to. Number one mistake is that we do not consume enough greens. I studied the chimpanzee diet, and chimpanzees they share 99.4% of the same sequence of genes with humans. They're very close, so close that the medical researchers, unfortunately, use them in the lab, and what they're trying to do, they're trying to put human illnesses on them. But the chimpanzees actually are so healthy that they do not contract any illness. They cannot, cannot get this HIV virus or hepatitis C virus. And so because they are very healthy, so I wanted to see what they eat and to get the rub some of their health on us humans. And I was shocked to figure out that their diet consists 40% out of greens, just green leaves. And when I research how much greens we consume, humans, in mainstream diet, it's just about 1%. And in the raw food diet, even just 5%, we definitely do not consume enough greens, which I consider right now is the most important and most nutrient part of our human diet. And another interesting paradox, I found that most people don't like greens. They hate greens. And I did extensive research about what is the reason why humans don't like greens, the thing that they need most, seems like. And I found the reason. I link it to the hydrochloric acid content of the stomach. I performed a study with a medical doctor in Oregon last year with a group of volunteers who had low hydrochloric acid diagnosed in their stomach. And we gave them blended greens for 30 days every day, and in the end of 1 month, their hydrochloric acid level raised average 66.8%, and their altogether health was improved, which shows that the healing power of chlorophyll could even fix that. And what's interesting that in the beginning they didn't like greens at all. By the end of experiment, they started to crave greens. So we need hydrochloric acid in order to liquefy the cellulose in greens so the greens and nutrients in them could be digested at all. And when we don't have enough hydrochloric acid, the body rejects it. The body says, hey, I don't want that. We feel nauseous if we eat greens when we don't have enough stomach acid. So that's very interesting, I find. And that's why right now I'm promoting drinking green, blended green, I call them green smoothies. But green smoothies would not be palatable if not blended with fruit. So I blend greens with the bananas and mangoes and other fruit, grapes, whatever, apples. And this makes it so palatable because the flavor of fruit, the taste of fruit totally dominates the flavor of greens. And even children love it. It looks very bright green color, kind of scary, but when you taste it, it tastes nothing but fruit. And then they eventually, after a few weeks of drinking that every day, maybe one quart a day or two quarts a day, many people begin to feel such a great relief and feel better. And if you want me to talk about the second mistake that people make on raw food, is that we all grown up with bread, with lots of pasta, lots of cooked carbohydrates. And when we go on raw food diet, we miss it tremendously. And in order to substitute this cooked carbohydrates with something, we want to make a mock bread or fake pizza or something kind of pizza. We make it from nuts and seeds, which are actually 70% fat. So we substitute carbohydrates with fats. And eventually, when it accumulates in the body breaks down. Lots of symptoms, fatigue, drop in energy, weight gain, irritable colon, all kinds of symptoms that show that overeating nuts is not a good idea. It's a very hard to digest product and has to be eaten in moderation. And there actually, I found out there were 7 common mistakes that people make, but I don't know if we have time to go through all of them today.
No, I'd like to just say that, Anne Wigmore, what basically I think you're saying is that we're not consuming enough greens, and that the importance of greens was, as Anne Wigmore said, that the molecule of chlorophyll, yeah, maybe you can explain that, the importance of the greens and its link to our blood system.
Yes. Actually, the chlorophyll, a molecule of chlorophyll, is the original molecule of carbohydrate, that the only prime molecule of carbohydrate that exists on this planet. Everything, all of the rest of the carbohydrates come from derived from chlorophyll. Like some other, then it transforms to other parts of the plant and turns into sugars. So chlorophyll is liquefied sunshine. Chlorophyll is created under the direct sunshine, and it's extremely valuable, extremely healing. And the molecule of chlorophyll in green plants that grow on the planet of on the planet Earth, on the surface. I'm not speaking about all kinds of algae and sea vegetables. This is called chlorophyll A from the plants on Earth. It looks like a ring, and it resembles very closely the human molecule of blood. And there's only one atom different. And to eat and consume greens is like having an infusion of a fresh blood. It's very, very healing and rejuvenating to anybody. The other chlorophylls from sea vegetables and from algae are also beneficial, but not as beneficial as the one that come from greens, green plants that grow on a surface.
So let's get back to this, the whole idea, which I think is so important, which you've mentioned earlier, is that I think you're saying people aren't consuming enough greens, dark
uh-huh.
greens, leafy greens.
No.
Even if they're having a big salad, they think they're eating a portion or three portions of greens, but it's the dark leafy greens that really count.
Yes, any greens would count, the darker the better. But what we call a bowl of salad usually is just two leaves of romaine sliced, and they're so fluffy that they fill the bowl, and then we pour some dressing in it, and we say, well, I eat green salad every day, or we just have a wilted iceberg leaf lettuce in our Subway sandwich and say, oh, I eat greens every day. But when in nature, I think when humans were living closer to nature, I believe it was only like 300 years ago, the humans were consuming much larger quantities of greens and much darker, maybe two bunches equal to two bunches of dinosaur kale, two bunches of big bunches of spinach like you buy in the store. But in order to chew it so you really so it could become digestible, you have to rapture every cell, because greens, they all consist from, the cells are covered with cellulose, so you have to really chew it so thoroughly. It will take hours and hours of chewing. That is why chimpanzees, they spend 6 hours every day chewing. In our everyday life today, in modern life, we cannot do it, and so that's why I decided that the blender would be the right thing to use to help to already mulch it for us, like munch it for us, so when we consume it, it's already chewed thoroughly. And then it goes into the stomach, and if we have adequate amount of chlorophyll, acid, stomach acid in there, then it starts digesting, and then it goes into small intestines where it absorbs all the nutrients like calcium, potassium, iron, vitamin B, all the nutrients, they get absorbed in our blood from small intestines.
Now, I was always mesmerized by the idea that even when you put a food into your mouth, your stomach is already secreting the correct enzyme to digest that particular food. But when talking about green smoothies, and I personally am an advocate of that, and it's been tremendous. My smoothies are dark green. You know, it's only in the last few years that I've been growing this lacinato kale or the dinosaur kale, which is available at many of the stores in Vancouver here now. But people are getting sufficient of these greens, and which is easily to assimilate into your body because you put it through a blender. Now, my question is this, is that, you know, some of the older conventional wisdom was that you didn't really combine greens with fruits, but, you know, you're doing that now.
I can answer that. The wisdom was don't combine fruit and vegetable. However, there is a misconception of what is vegetable. For example, let's look at the carrot. I took the root of the carrot and the leaves of the carrot, and I calculated the entire nutritional value of each of these parts. And I have these tables in my book. I just took several of those vegetables. And I show what a tremendous difference there is between contents of roots and contents of leaves. For example, roots have lots of carbohydrate in it, and it would be very bad for combining it with fruit. It will cause gas and even feeling nauseous. But the greens, they're perfect for combining with fruit. In fact, in nature, chimpanzees, whenever they grab a fruit, then they always will grab a piece of grass and eat it after the fruit to improve digestion. Greens are perfectly digested mixed with fruit, and greens are not vegetables. We should change it, and we should consider greens a different food group, maybe a new food group, and which has lots of representatives. There, I've counted 34 kinds of greens that you could get in today's stores and markets. But just understand that greens are not vegetables. We cannot mix. It's not recommended to mix together fruits and vegetables, but greens are not vegetables. Greens are separate, and greens perfectly blend with the fruits. And even Herbert Shelton and Ann Wigmore, they considered greens to be easily mixable with anything.
Now, we're talking with Victoria Potenko, and she and her husband, they are highly acclaimed authors, written a number of books about her family and her personal experiences, and she's also an inspirational speaker, and there's going to be a full-day event here in Vancouver on the 25th of March, Saturday the 25th of March. It's a full-day event, and it's... you know, I so much love this program because it's changed my life, and I love to spread this the good news about greens and getting the enzymes that we all need for health and as you speak from yourself, as you spoke earlier, your family had a number of major degenerative diseases, and you were able to clear them. But you're going to be speaking in Victoria. You're going to be going to Courtney on Vancouver Island. But just give us a little... you mind if I just give you a little rundown here? I have the information of what's happening here on Saturday, March the 25th. And people should go to the webpage rawbc.org, and you'll see the events there, phone numbers to call, and you have your workshop scheduled there. It's a full day event, and the person Aaron Ash will be preparing some of the food there, a gourmet dinner, and he was running a store on Commercial Drive. What was it called, John? Roots, I think, was called Roots.
Eternal Abundance,
and he's well known to many Vancouver people. And so, not only will you and your husband be presenting there, but Aaron Ash will be there as well. And rawbc.org, and you have a webpage as well.
Yes, rawfamily.com.
Raw Family, and you were here before.
Oh, this is my fifth year. I come every year in February or March. This is the fifth year.
And people should wonder why they're calling you back each time, and you speak to pretty much full houses every time. There's a slight charge for this, but people can get that from the web page there. So, we have only a few minutes left here, but I wanted to ask you about the advantages of the green smoothies as opposed to juicing. Maybe you can give us a little rundown here, because a lot of people are still caught up on juicing, and what's the difference here between the smoothie and the juice?
The juice, I consider, is a fractured food because the very important nutrient is removed, the fiber. And the smoothie is a complete food. Fiber is extremely important. Fiber is necessary for elimination. Under the microscope, fiber looks like a sponge, and it absorbs about 6 to 8 times more toxins of the size of that piece of fiber. And without enough fiber, we cannot eliminate. We accumulate toxins in our body, in our colon, and then we have what we call detox. I believe now that if one has detox, then that person doesn't consume enough fiber. So the green smoothies, they're perfect for that. And I also wanted, if I have a minute, to talk about the proteins. Despite the fact that America is number one consumer of animal protein in the world, it's almost the first number one also in having depression and suicide rate. But what is the main symptom of lack of protein is depression and cravings for unhealthy foods. So that's obvious that eating animal protein doesn't really help us. As soon as people begin to drink green smoothies, they begin to feel that they don't experience any more cravings for any unhealthy foods, drinking alcohol or smoking, they say. It just vanishes. And also the mood of people becomes so well. For example, I just started singing in the car after I started to drink green smoothies on a regular basis because the greens have the most easy digestible protein like tyrosine and tryptophan in large amounts, much, much larger than in the root vegetables or in fruits. So this is also a source of very high-quality protein.
Thank you, Victoria, for being on Animal Voices. You are indeed a well-known author and inspirational speaker, and you have had several best-selling books on raw and living foods. And, of course, you'll be in Vancouver on the 25th of March, in which you'll reveal many of your new discoveries. And my co-host, John, has a question here for you.
Yes.
Hi, Victoria.
Hello.
Now, how do you make, like, salad, for example? You want to make that delicious, don't you? And many people do that ordinarily with oils and salts and various strong flavors like that. Do you use salt, for example? Do you use oils in your cooking or non-cooking? And do you use other flavor enhancers make the food
palatable?
Mike,
thank you so much for your question. Thank you so much. I used to consume so much oils that I started to gain weight on raw food. And I gained almost 60 pounds of being 100% raw. That was crazy. And what happened when I started to drink green smoothies last year in September on a regular basis is my taste buds changed to such a degree that I do not want any more oil. My body rejects oil. What I do for, I use smoothie for the dressing, but I make it savory. I take avocado and bell pepper, blend it together with some lemon juice, with some parsley, whatever I want to put in there, if I want to put little pepper or dulse leaves, and I stopped consuming salt altogether. And then I just use it as a dressing. And it's so delicious to me, and actually my staff here at Raw Family Office also use. We just have a break at 1:30 and eat that every day. Everybody seems to like it. We make it slightly different every day. So I don't eat salads with the dressings that I used to make before. It changed. Uh-huh.
So that's quite an evolution for you too, then.
Yes, I think it's bringing raw food to the next level, and I have collected a compilation of 300 recipes of green smoothies. Very different, amazing. And my new book called Green Smoothie Revolution is coming sometime in May. It's just a recipe book of green smoothies, and it's going to be wonderful.
That's great. It's usually very difficult to motivate people who don't feel any need to change. People often have to get sick or have a crisis in order to really change. Eh?
You see, I've been teaching about raw food for over 12 years, and I have came to the conclusion, to observation, that majority of people cannot change their lifestyle for good and stay on it. And I just became upset, with kind of disappointed. But with the green smoothie, you do not have to change the diet. You can keep eating what you're eating and even drinking alcohol if you want. But what will happen to you, you will lose the interest into this bad foods that you want to, not unwanted food. And you will naturally lean towards wanting salads. And then people report to me, Victoria, I'm suddenly 80% raw. I didn't even expect it.
Thank you, Victoria Botenko. Greens can save your life. So people can go to rawbc.org, hear all about the presentation. Thank you for being on Animal Voices. And over
thank you,
to,
Carl.
Thank you, Victoria. And over to Marge Adams.
Thank you for that, Carl. A very interesting interview. Alan, could we have just a couple of bars of music, please? Thanks. Here's a little story that I'd like to close with. It's called Of Dogs and Angels. During my years in animal welfare work, I served as the president of the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. I have heard wonderful stories about the power of the human-animal bond. One of my favorites is about a girl and her very special dog. When the girl was born, the tiny baby spiked a fever of 106 degrees. And this alarming fever continued to recur, but the baby survived. When the episode was over, the child was left with 13 different seizure causes, including epilepsy. She had what was called multiple seizure syndrome and had several seizures every day. Sometimes she stopped breathing. As a result, the little girl could never be left alone. She grew to be a teenager, and if her mother had to go out, her father and brothers had to accompany her everywhere, including the bathroom, which was awkward for everyone. But the risk of leaving her alone was too great, and so, for the lack of a better solution, things went on this way for years. The girl and her family lived near a town where there was a penitentiary for women. One of the programs there was a dog training program. The inmates were taught how to train dogs to foster a sense of competence as well as to develop job skills for the time they left prison. Although most of the women had serious criminal backgrounds, many made excellent dog trainers and often trained service dogs for the handicapped while serving their time. The girl's mother read about this program and contacted the penitentiary to see if there was anything they could do for her daughter. They had no idea how to train dogs to help a girl's condition, but her family decided that a companion dog would be good for the girl as she had limited social opportunities and they felt she would enjoy a dog's company. The girl chose a random dog named Queenie and, together with the women at the prison, trained her to be an obedient pet. But Queenie had other plans. She became a seizure alert dog, letting the girl know when a seizure was coming on so that the girl could be ready for it. I heard about Queenie's amazing ability and went to visit the girl's family and met Queenie. At one point during my visit, Queenie became agitated and took the girl's wrist in her mouth and started pulling her towards the living room couch. Her mother said, "Go on now, listen to what Queenie's telling you." The girl went to the couch, curled up in the fetal position, facing the back of the couch, and within minutes started to seize. The dog jumped on the couch and wedged herself between the back of that couch and the front of the girl's body, placing her ear in front of the girl's mouth. Her family was used to this performance, but I watched in open-mouthed astonishment as the girl finished seizing and Queenie relaxed with her on the couch, wagging her tail for all the world like an ordinary dog playing with her mistress. Then the girl and the dog went to the girl's bedroom as her parents and I went to the kitchen for coffee. A little while later, Queenie came barreling down the hallway barking. She did a U-turn in the kitchen and then went racing back to the girl's room. "She's having a seizure," the mother told me. The girl's father got up in what seemed to me a casual manner for someone whose daughter often stopped breathing and walked back to the bedroom with Queenie. My concern must have been evident on my face because the girl's mother smiled and said, "I know what you're thinking. But you see, that's not the bark Queenie uses when my daughter stops breathing." I shook my head in amazement. Queenie, the self-taught angel, proved to me once again how utterly foolish it is to suppose that animals don't think or can't communicate. And that's by Roger Karras. Now we have to close off very quickly. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices. We will be replayed once again on Monday at 4 o'clock, 4 to 5, and please come back again next Friday, 12 to 1, and we'll be having another show. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.